The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
The number of Americans filing claims for unemployment benefits has hit a record high for a single week as the coronavirus slams the economy. Nearly 3.3 million people now out of work.
Coronavirus infections have passed the 500,000 mark worldwide tonight with 23,000 deaths. And the United States now has more than any other country, including 1,100 deaths. Meanwhile, a huge economic rescue bill is nearing final approval in Congress.
After days of intense discussions, the Senate has reached a bipartisan agreement on a historic relief package for this pandemic. It will rush new resources onto the front lines of our nation's healthcare fight, and it will inject trillions of dollars of cash into the economy as fast as possible.
We have averted for now what was the real risk of an accelerating economic and financial deleveraging. And at the end of that road would have been a 1930s-like depression and a 2008-like financial disruption. So the good news is that for now we have averted that. The less good news is we have a very tough economic and financial road ahead of us. The stimulus isn't going to be effective immediately. You need to build pipes. There will be massive layoffs. There will be bankruptcies. So we're not out of the woods, but at least we're not on the path to something really nasty.
Governor Cuomo says we're still weeks away from hitting the peak in New York City, a scenario which could collide with the president's new timeline, proposing to ease restrictions by Easter Sunday. That's April 12th.
What a great timeline this would be. Easter is our timeline. What a great timeline.
But even the nation's top health experts recommending not committing to any date.
That's really very flexible. We just had a conversation with the president in the Oval Office talking about, you know, you can look at a date, but you've got to be very flexible and on a literally day by day and week by week basis.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Unemployment claims skyrocket to a record 3.3 million this week as work shutdowns begin to hit the economy hard. Congress passes MOAB, the mother of all stimulus bombs, of $2 trillion on Friday, and the Fed extends its QE to include the purchase of investment-grade bonds and ETFs, and the markets have a three-day run of 3,500 points on the Dow, including one of the biggest jumps in the Dow since 1933. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's Financial Sense News Hour. Joining me is Jonathan Krinsky. He thinks the bottom in stocks is not in just yet, but he said volatility has peaked. Jonathan thinks we still need to keep some powder dry. Also later on in the broadcast, Mike McClone from Bloomberg Commodities, he sees a deflationary wave hitting the economy with interest rates heading to zero and gold taking out its old highs. Later on in the broadcast, in the big picture, Chris Sheridan and I will discuss MOAB, this mother of all stimulus bombs, as Congress indeed passed a $2 trillion stimulus bill on Friday. It's expected to go to the president's desk and signed immediately. But first, let's talk to Ryan Poplava on events moving the markets this week.
Well, thanks, Jim. We continue to see the unprecedented actions by the Federal Reserve, by Treasury, and by Congress this week. And those actions have been shaping the trading in the financial markets, starting off with just a slew of new catalysts on Monday. Honestly, there's enough going on from these three entities to just make your head spin. So let's talk about how we started the week off. Yeah, and we started the week off with a limit down on futures on Sunday night on news that the Senate failed to get enough procedural votes for its stimulus bill. But that action was reversed when the Federal Reserve lifted the $700 billion cap on Treasury purchases and said they would buy in the amounts needed, in quotes. You know, translated, that's not QE4 or QE10.0 or 4.5 or 5. That's freaking QE Infinity 0.0. So try to beat that, next Fed chairman. On top of the Infinity Treasuries, The Fed announced yet another credit facility to buy investment-grade corporate debt, municipal debt, and U.S.-listed exchange ETFs for investment-grade corporate bonds, all a first this time around for the Fed. Gold shot up incredibly on the news of, obviously, Infinity QE, and based on bullish comments from Goldman Sachs on Tuesday, finished right back up to test around $1,700 by Tuesday before settling back down around $1,650 by the end of the week. Treasuries also benefited with a sharp rally after last week's sell-off. The 10-year fell down to 0.76% on the news, and the stock market still closed down on Monday despite the big announcement, as investors clearly voted their confidence, or lack thereof, really, in Congress with liquidations. Later on in the week, Powell told NBC's Today show that the Fed isn't going to run out of ammunition and will provide the credit markets a backstop where needed. So that was pretty much, you know, a lot of the news that we got on Federal Reserve this week. Was a very big catalyst. But again, without Congress in the early parts of the week with its act together, investors pretty much voted their lack of confidence in the stock market. But Tuesday's catalyst and the main catalyst for the rally in the stocks was the understanding that Congress was finally getting close to an agreement. Senate Minority Leader Schumer said negotiations were at the two-yard line on Tuesday, and by the early hours on Wednesday, an agreement was reached for stimulus of $2 trillion. Some small details were still being discussed, but by the end of the day, a vote was delayed until Thursday, which finally passed 96-0. Congress might have been spurned by the dramatic increase to unemployment claims, up 3 million to around 3.283 million unemployment claims. At the close on Thursday, the S&P 500 had rallied 20% from that Monday intraday low. The only thing holding the market back on Friday was concern whether a voice vote or recorded vote was necessary in the House due to a couple of reps that wanted to hold a voice vote. But it finally passed without any delay, and that was a positive that helped stem some of the profit taking on Friday. At one point, the S&P was about to turn positive when a message from management of United Airlines shot a dose of reality and shut things down on that rally. The message read, they aren't going to conduct involuntary furloughs, which was a concern, but the bad news came when management said it doesn't expect a rebound in air travel until next year. You know, obviously investors want to see a V-like recovery in the economy, just like they've seen V-like recoveries in the stock market currently this week, as well as at the 2019 bottom and back to 2009, the V-bottom we had there at the turn of those bear markets. So that's what's been hoped for. I think we're still in it, unfortunately, for the long haul. So really, those were the main catalysts this week, Fed and Congress, and the unprecedented levels they're taking to stem the tide of COVID-19. Now, Trump gave General Motors orders Friday to produce ventilators under the Defense Production Act. So even the White House is taking unprecedented levels and measures. President Trump gave a goal when he'd like to have the country back open for business as of April 12th, but will make that decision based on expert advice from health officials. Some may recall his statement about the crisis lasting until July or August. And obviously, looking at how things have spread worldwide, that's probably still a legitimate concern. And that caused negative reaction in stocks earlier in the month. But this communication was sought as a positive. I've sent personally communication to my staff that I don't see us coming back in the office until the governor and Trump remove the bans. You know, we continue to operate at full capacity with our advisors and portfolio management team, but from home. And we stand united and our spirits are high to serve and assist our clients through this. And the communication has been very positive thus far. And I told the team on Wednesday that two out of the four catalysts I've been hoping to see that we've been following very closely, which was the Fed and finally fiscal stimulus, have now passed. The other two, which is essentially a deceleration in new U.S. cases of COVID-19 and finally the lift on that ban, like I mentioned, that's what's left. It's going to take some patience here, and that's really going to be key for investors. And I think the hardest part in all this, the easy part behind us, the Fed doing what it knew it needed to do, it didn't act shyly and continues, as I said earlier, they're going to do whatever it takes, going to continue to purchase in amounts needed to backstop the credit markets and make sure things are functioning properly, which they weren't before, and we were able to take advantage of some of those situations. But you know, essentially, the last two catalysts, that's ahead of us. and they're unknown at this point. So we still need a little bit of patience here.
FS Insider spoke with the geopolitical consultant and expert on international affairs, Jacob Shapiro, about the four major changes that coronavirus is going to have on the world for not just weeks, months, but years to come into the future. Here's some of what he told our audience on FS Insider this week.
Comparative advantage meant that China could do things cheaper, better, and more reliably than anybody else. Comparative advantage was the thing that you wanted to make sure you had in your supply chain so you could drive down costs. That's over now. Now you're going to have to start thinking about political advantage. It's not about getting the lowest price. It's about getting the lowest price from the most politically reliable supplier. This goes for pharma. This goes for aerospace. This goes for a lot of different sectors. We had warnings in 2008. We had warnings in 2011. We had warnings from the person who wrote China RX. And unfortunately, we're going to have to learn the lesson now. And we're going to learn the lesson now with shortages of masks, with shortages of important medication, with shortages of all kinds of products. And I think that shortage and how visceral that's going to be for people, that's finally going to tip it over.
To gain access to this full interview, in addition to all of our other interviews airing 3 days every week, go to financialsense.com and hit subscribe.
Are you tired of earning a minimal interest rate on your investments? Are you looking for a higher rate of return on your money? Financial Sense Wealth Management has put together a portfolio of high dividend paying blue chips, high quality interest paying bonds, and preferred stocks. Our income account portfolio is specifically designed to help meet the needs of retirees, pension funds, and foundations looking to increase income and reduce taxes. To learn more, contact us at 888-486-3939 or email grow@financialsense.com.
We're just about to get the mother of all stimulus bombs, a $2 trillion or maybe even more stimulus package expected to be signed on Friday. Well, that has the market with high hopes. But is this a bear market rally in further lows ahead of us? Joining us on the program is Jonathan Krinsky. Jonathan, let's begin with a piece that you guys sent out at Baycrest, and that is the S&P needs to start outperforming and large cap can't have its cake and eat it too. Let's go with some of those themes and explain what you mean.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. Always great to be on. So really what we were referring to specifically in that note was the fact that large cap technology slash growth, and for that as a proxy, we've been using the NASDAQ 100, right? That's the 100 very large cap, high growth, and predominantly tech-focused names. So we're looking at that index, and we all know that that's been a great relative outperformer over the last any number of years, really. But within that, there are always periods where you see that underperform the broad market or the S&P 500. And leading into January and February, when everything topped, the NASDAQ was already outperforming. And what we saw since then is that outperformance actually accelerate even throughout the correction. So S&P and NASDAQ 100 both went down, of course, but the NASDAQ 100 went down less. So if we look at a ratio or relative strength of the NASDAQ to the S&P in the correction, the NASDAQ has actually continued to surge relative to the S&P. And that is very unusual and rare. And in fact, if we go back over 40 years of history we have for the NASDAQ 100, we've really never seen a meaningful pullback where the NASDAQ has outperformed like that. So what that tells us is that we probably are not out of the woods yet. We've actually started to begin the last couple of days to see the NASDAQ relinquish some of that relative strength to the S&P over the bounce we've had. So we think regardless whether we put in a final low or not, we think the NASDAQ's probably going to show some relative underperformance for a couple weeks or even a couple months. But more likely, we're going to see some sort of retest over the next couple weeks or months in the overall averages. And that's when we think you'll finally see some more meaningful underperformance in some of the large cap tech and growth names.
Jonathan, let's talk about some of the FANG stocks, because you allude that many of them could be vulnerable stocks like Apple, Microsoft, Google, Facebook, some of these companies that have been obviously the outperformers over the last couple of years. And as you've talked about, the NASDAQ was outperforming at the top, and it's been outperforming on the bottom. So let's talk about some of these big FANG stocks.
Yeah, I mean, I think they've been kind of a safe haven trade to some extent. They're liquid, they're big, they're obviously not going away, even if we have a severe recession. But I think that inherently is, at this point, is some of the risk. And again, it doesn't mean they have to go down a lot on an absolute basis, but I think they're probably going to underperform a bit. But they could go down a bit on an absolute basis. So if you take Apple, for instance, it's really just now sitting on its 200-day moving average, even with I think it was down about 30-plus percent off the highs. You know, typically bear markets, like we saw, let's say at the end of 2018, Apple got, you know, quite a bit below its 200-day moving average. And of course, most of the other bear markets, if we go back to 2007, 2008. So, you know, could this be the bottom? Jim, it always could be. But I think, you know, as we look historically in deep bear markets, we're probably not done until you see some real capitulation in some of the large cap leadership stocks.
You know, typically when you see these market bottoms, there's usually that one moment in time, Jonathan, we call it the puke point, where the last sellers just, it's like a capitulation. They just say, I want out, get me out of here, sell at any price. And that usually marks the bottom. There's a big spike in volume. It's a big down day. It's one of those 90% down days. We've seen a number of 90% down days. What would you be looking at specifically to tell you that, yeah, this looks like a bottom?
Well, yeah, and to that point, the low so far of this pullback or bear market, whatever you want to call it, on Monday was actually not the heaviest volume. So I think that's certainly interesting. You know, one of the things along the lines that we were talking about, the large cap tech issue, if we look at something like the Dow Jones Market Neutral Momentum Index, and it's a little complicated, but basically this index looks to replicate a strategy of going long high momentum stocks and short low momentum stocks. So in bear markets, that tends to outperform because it obviously has a short component to it. So what we found looking back historically is you actually need that index to start underperforming the S&P by quite a bit before we put in a meaningful low. And we can look at something on that ratio when that weekly ratio crosses back above its 20-week moving average. That tends to be a pretty good signal. So we're quite a bit of ways away from that. So that's one thing we'll look at. You know, I think you could make the case or the argument that we've seen the peak in volatility. And oftentimes, and the closest analogy would be 2008, when we saw the peak of volatility in October of 2008, but then the bear market obviously didn't conclude until March 2009. So that's certainly a scenario here where we've seen some sort of capitulation, and certainly the fear as judged by the volatility has peaked, but then we need to go back and retest, and you'll see a lot of bullish divergences there. So, you know, you never really know. I think there's a lot of constructive action happening in the last couple of days, but we'll have to see, you know, how the market reacts once we start hitting some more meaningful levels of resistance, probably looking more like 2,700 on the S&P. And, you know, how it acts once we get up there. So those are just some of the things we're looking at.
On the day you and I are doing this interview, it's a Thursday, and we just got the unemployment claims that jumped over 3 million. I wonder if we can just spend a few minutes talking about that, because I've never seen anything like this in my 40-year career. And I think you were looking at a chart, and this thing just stands out like anything we've ever seen before.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. And, you know, as market analysts, specifically technical analysts, we're always more concerned with the market's reaction or the stock's reaction to the news than in the news itself. So I think so far the action today tells you that, yes, it was a shocking number, but I don't think anybody was surprised by it given what's been going on. So, you know, that's certainly a good example of looking at the market's reaction, not necessarily what the number is, but, you know, what the market does. So that's certainly interesting. But then, you know, below the surface, what is really standing out to us today is that, again, the NASDAQ 100 is massively underperforming. Yesterday, actually, the ratio of the NASDAQ 100 to the S&P was its second worst day in the last decade. So we're really starting to see that happen on the upside here, where those typical large cap FANG stocks, yes, they're going up, but they're actually lagging quite a bit. And that's again, not surprising given the massive outperformance we had, not only coming into the peak of the market, but throughout the bulk of the correction.
I want to move on to two other sectors. I want to look at interest rates. If you take a look at 10-year Treasury notes, we got down to almost like 0.3%. Then we jumped to 1.2. Now we're below, on the day we're doing this, we're right around 0.9. Let's talk about interest rates and what the charts are telling you.
So I think if we're talking about sort of capitulatory moves or the apex of some sort of move, what we saw in early March in interest rates was pretty phenomenal. You know, if we want to talk about volumes, we can look at something like the TLT, which is the 20-year Treasury ETF, and that just had absolutely the biggest volume on both an absolute share basis and notional value basis on record back on March 9th. And that so far has been the high on TLT. So I think you could make the case that we put in some sort of meaningful inflection in interest rates. You know, you could also argue with the Fed doing unprecedented bond buying, quantitative easing, and despite that, we still can't make new highs on bonds or new lows on yields. That also speaks to the fact that maybe we're at some sort of major inflection point in interest rates. But, you know, again, when we're talking about a 40-year bull market in bonds, you know, it's very tough to say that that's the end of it. But those are just some things that I think do stand out. Also, we're seeing interest rates in Japan, which we know have been going down for decades, are starting to actually turn up a little bit. So there's some things out there that are certainly getting our attention. And, you know, again, I think it's too early to call the absolute end of the bull market in bonds, but it's certainly acting a bit differently than maybe it has in the past.
I want to move on to gold, which this has certainly got to be positive for gold when you have the government issuing or about to issue about $2 trillion worth of stimulus. The Fed is injecting massive amounts, trillions of dollars, backstopping not only the corporate bond market, currency swaps, and now even going in and buying investment grade bonds and investment grade ETFs. So let's move over to the topic of gold.
Yeah, so gold was acting very well to start the year, of course. So it was acting more like even like a risk on asset. And it actually held up pretty well until early March when there was just complete liquidation across all asset classes. But it's actually snapped back very well. And it's, you know, it's really consolidating kind of in that 1600, 1650 range. But I think the key point here is that it's done that despite or in the face of an extremely strong US dollar. So if you're to look at gold in almost any other global currency, it's actually even more impressive. So I think if we were to go back to the 2008 financial playbook, what we saw was gold did get liquidated throughout the worst part of the bear market. And then once people realized that there was going to be pretty big quantitative easing going on and the dollar started to weaken, that's when gold really started to perform very well. And obviously, we know that started the move up to its all-time record high in 2011. So I think we're starting to see the dollar actually price some of that. And it's been, I think it was up 11 straight days, and then it's been down the last couple of days. So I think continued weakness in the dollar will only benefit the gold trade. And just, you know, if we're looking at price only, it's done what it's expected to do. It had the pullback in mid-March, kind of chopped around its 200-day moving average around 1,500, and then snapped back pretty nicely back above 1,600. So we still think it's set up to challenge its all-time highs, possibly push up towards $2,000 an ounce. You know, whether that's in a few months or later this year remains to be seen, but we're still you know, fairly constructive on gold here.
So given what you see right now as an investor, what would you be recommending? You know, keep cash on the sidelines, keep some powder dry, maybe sort of begin to dabble or get your toes into the markets. What would you be doing?
Yeah, so I think you can look at some of the places or areas of the market that have already priced in, you know, maybe more of a downturn than some of the large cap tech names have. And one area we've been highlighting are the small caps, actually. So the Russell 2000, they nearly got down to their 2016 lows. So we've actually been suggesting small caps over the NASDAQ 100 for at least a trade. And that's been working starting to work the last few days. You know, I think if we think that the dollar is going to continue to roll over a bit, emerging markets are not a bad place to start dabbling. They've been hit a lot harder, but we still think, yeah, definitely keep some powder dry. Our best guess is that we will see a retest. We know that December of 2018, obviously the lows did not see a retest. Everyone knows that March of 2009 did not see a retest of the lows. But if you go back to the 2008-2009 bear market, you could argue that we saw the peak of volatility in October, November of 08, and then the break into 09 was the retest. It obviously went a lot deeper, but you know, it depends what you define as the retest. But we think the final capitulation will ultimately see those large cap FANG, tech names, high growth, whatever you want to call it. And that's, you know, probably your signal that the worst is over. So that's kind of how we're viewing things right now.
Jonathan, in your career, have you ever seen anything like this? I'm just thinking back to mid-February. The market was at an all-time record. Unemployment was the lowest in 60 years. We had great reports on the ISM service sector. The jobs numbers were great. And that was 6 weeks ago. And look where we are today.
Yeah. You know, of course, we have not seen anything like this. I think if you're looking back historically at any similar periods that saw this type of velocity of decline, you know, you could highlight certainly October 1987, and then you have to kind of go back to 1929. And in fact, on Tuesday, I believe, we saw the biggest daily gain for the Dow Jones Industrial Average since 1933. And we know that, you know, if you look back historically, daily gains of over 10% on the Dow are extremely rare. And we've really only seen them within the confines of significant bear markets. So that's another reason, you know, it'd be very rare and really hasn't happened that we've seen a 10% daily gain that marked the absolute bottom of the bear market. Of course, could always be different this time, but you know, that just is another piece of the puzzle we're looking at that tells us that, yeah, you know, it feels good, enjoy the rally for now, but you know, that's not consistent with the end of the bear market. It's more middle to possibly late innings, but it's, you know, it's not the very end.
So when you take a look at this, how much do you think part of this is the result of the change in the structure of the market? And I'm thinking of the vast amount of money that's in index funds, algo trading. How much of that is playing into this?
You know, this is something that we've seen more and more, and the speed of information and the speed of trading that certainly, you know, maybe it's not surprising then that we have seen one of the fastest drawdowns we have ever seen. But also, I think the way it unfolded, you know, traditional bear markets somewhat are foretold by, you know, weakening economic factors, weakening internals in the market. And this was more of an exogenous shock, you know, that certainly escalated very quickly. So it is different in that sense. But yeah, I think the whole passive investing theme also is another reason why we think that, you know, the NASDAQ 100 needs to see some relative weakness. We said this at the start of the show that we've never really seen a meaningful drawdown where the NASDAQ 100 outperformed the entire way into the top, the entire way down, and the entire way up. And up until 2 days ago, that's what we had. So we think even though the market internals and dynamics do change over the years, human psychology does not. And while there was absolute fear in the markets over the last couple of weeks, I think when you look at the names that people have still been hiding in, I don't know that you can say that we've seen max fear in a lot of those type of large cap tech names.
All right. Well, listen, Jonathan, as we close, if our listeners want to follow the work that you do at Baycrest Partners, how could they do so?
Well, we are an institutional broker dealer. So if you're an institutional investor, you can certainly reach out to us via our website, baycrestpartners.com. Otherwise, you can follow me on Twitter, Jay Krinsky, PGA.
All right. Well, listen, Jonathan, stay safe and come back and talk again.
Of course. Happy to do it, Jim. We'll be right back.
Last month on February 26, Dr. Nada Sanders, a global supply chain expert, told listeners on our program that the disruption to the global supply chain from China coming offline would lead to a global recession in 2020. FS Insider caught up with her this week to discuss her latest book called The Hugh Machine, Humankind, Machines, and the Future of Enterprise. This was a very interesting and wide-ranging book looking at business strategy, philosophy of mind, behavioral psychology, and the limits of technology, leadership, and law. Here's a clip of what she had to say on how the coronavirus ties into some of the subject material of her book.
And it's interesting because if you look at today, right now, everybody's talking about, you know, what's going to happen with the virus, what's the propagation going to look like. And there is no algorithm that you can turn to that will exclusively rely on historical data and be able to tell you what it's going to do. Why? Because we don't have historical data specifically on this particular virus. And I think this is just a fantastic example of where you need human judgment, where you need expertise. So all of us are, you know, watching, well, what is, you know, Tony Fauci from the CDC going to tell us? Or what are the experts going to say from Mayo Clinic and WHO and Johns Hopkins? Because there is no algorithm. There are so many instances where we need humans.
As always, if you want to listen to this full interview and all of our other interviews airing 3 days during the week through our website or in a podcast app of your choice, all you have to do is go to financialsense.com and click subscribe.
We probably haven't seen volatility like this since 2008 and the financial crisis, and it's across all investment classes. Doesn't matter whether you're looking at stocks, bonds, or even commodities. Joining me from Bloomberg Markets is Mike McClone. And Mike, let's begin with gold, normally considered a hedge or a safe haven, but even gold has been going up and down like a roller coaster.
Yeah, it's had a correction, a little bit of a dip, and just like it did in 2008, but I think it's a temporary short-term situation. So let's look at gold today. We're on the 24th. This is Tuesday, and gold on the year is up 7%. The S&P 500 is down about 25%. So most people would say that's pretty good. It did dip down to about 1470 or so from a high of 1700. So it's had its correction. And it did the same thing in 2008. We've had pretty significant margin call selling in other assets, which pressured gold. But it's come right back. And I think what you see in gold now is that don't fight the Fed mantra favors gold much more than the stock market.
Let's talk about some of the things that could possibly push gold higher and take out its old highs reached back in 2011. Let's begin with debt to GDP. At the time you and I are speaking, they haven't quite signed the stimulus bill, but the talk is they're reaching an agreement, and that stimulus may amount to as much as $2 trillion.
Yeah, so we all know what the government needs to do, and the Federal Reserve, is just absolutely flood the system with money. And debt to GDP currently is running around 108%. The last time it really accelerated was when we did the same thing in 2008. It was about 60% or so then. The significance is it went straight up and stabilized just over 1% where we are now. And it never went down despite this pretty significant economic bull run we had. So I see 1900 in gold surpassing that level is just a matter of time if history is a guide. And it's probably going to happen a lot faster than we did in the rally after the 2008 crisis, partly because this is global. We're seeing more monetary and fiscal stimulus on a global scale than I think ever. Unprecedented is probably the proper term. We've seen the stock market volatility recover. It's recovering from a lower base than it did in 2007. It was at 2007, you look at the VIX volatility index, it reached the lowest for longest ever. And then we just did that 2018. So it's coming back up. And then, of course, we see what's happening with most other currencies. Gold has already made new highs in terms of the euro, the British pound, the Indian rupee, the Canadian loonie. You just tick them off. It's just a matter of time it does it in the dollar.
And let's talk about a second reason. Gold is showing a divergent strength versus the dollar. Normally, when you see the dollar strengthening, as it has since the beginning of the year, gold typically moves in the reverse direction. It's showing a divergence. That isn't the case now.
Yeah, it's the broad measure of the dollar is up about 9% in the year. That's from the Federal Reserve. And gold is up about the same amount. And that is very rare. Typically, when the dollar's up that much, gold will decline. But one thing to remember about gold, it's the most one of the most stable assets in history measured over time. It's only really fluctuates in terms of that paper currency it's measured in. For instance, the 1 acre of farmland in Iowa is basically about 6 ounces of gold for the last 30 years. And, you know, they always say one's a couple, I think it's how many ounces for a home or maybe 1 ounce for a good man's suit. It's that currency that matters. So we've seen dollar strength, but measured versus other currencies. But when you measure and when they're all going down, there's only one really stabilized measure, and that's obviously property, physical assets, and then the most liquid global measure is gold. So that's the way I see it. It's just appreciating in terms of that paper currency. It's really more holistically, the mass, the supply of that paper currency has just kicked into substantial increases, which favors that physical solid asset, gold.
I want to move on next to volatility, which we've seen across all asset classes, whether you're looking at stocks, you're looking at bonds, or even commodities. You know, Mike, it's hard to believe on January 22nd of this year, the VIX was at 12. In less than, 6 weeks, it was all the way up at 85, 86. We haven't seen anything like this. You'd probably have to go back to the financial crisis.
Well, that's the key thing about, I'm glad you mentioned the VIX, because to me, that's been my key barometer. And I had the same signal back in 2007. It was early, but one thing I learned being an options trader in Chicago trading pits is volatility is always mean reverting, and that's what it's doing now. Now, the last time we had a spike like we had recently was in 2008, and that was a good indication that the market's going to continue to go down. But I like to look at the VIX on a measured, like a 50-week or 100-week average. And on a 50-week average, the VIX is running around $18. It spiked about 42 and reached 42 in 2008. I fully expect it to get there. The reason is because it made an all-time low at the end of 2018. And that's what kind of threw me for a loop. Because to me, 2019 making an all-time new high, and what you just mentioned a month ago, the stock market was at all-time new highs. To me, that was the dead cat bounce, very similar to 1929. Very similar to 2000, where you have maximum greed and really unsustainable prices when people expected a new high plateau. So all we're doing is mean reverting now. The VIX was a good indication. And that's where I come over to the stock market and deflation. We've had deflationary trends in commodities since the 2008 crisis, i.e. the crude oil. Crude oil peaked around 145 and just last week it bottomed at 20. That's a pretty much a 90% correction. Virtually every commodity has had major issues, but there's just no signs of demand pull in the world and there's massive supply. So there's no issues with the deflationary market. The stock market got a little bit too expensive. And typically, historically, when you have corrections like this, they usually last a while. It'd be lucky if we get a V bottom, but that was the problem to me with 2018. Remember, that was that low on it was Christmas Eve of 2018. It just was a V bottom, went straight up. That is, since we're basically right at that low right now in the S&P 500, and to me, that was a bit of an indication that this was just too excessive. So it looks to me like we have a period, based on history, of subdued and underperforming stock market.
And another factor that comes in on the day you and I are speaking, which is a Tuesday, we've got 10-year Treasury notes down below 1% again. We've got the 30-year bond at, a little over 1 or close to 1.4%. Let's talk about negative yields and what that means for gold.
Yes. Well, so let's look at the old days of gold. I remember in the 70s, I had a bank account when I was a kid and I earned about 10%. And it was wonderful. It was matching inflation. But those days of your money earning income are over in terms of T-bills and things. And because of that, you don't have that appreciation. That used to be the key thing. You'd get a decent real return, and that was made gold less attractive. But now we don't get any real return, and we're printing tons of money, basically monetizing that, increasing the supply of our money. So it behooves us, to me, it's just simply prudence. Take some of those dollars, those physical pieces of paper, and convert it to a solid asset like gold. So to me, that's where gold has very sustained price tailwinds. Because you don't have any chance of getting income on your money. You mentioned the 30-year. I love watching the 30. I started in that trading pit in the 80s. And I see the 30-year, every bond in the world is heading towards zero. No, I mean, risk of free bonds like the U.S. And the 30-year recently dipped to 1%, popped in near 2%. Now we're like 1.4, which you mentioned. It should continue to gravitate towards zero. I don't think it's going to get there because that's what it has been doing since 1982. And that's what the German bund is or has done. That's what the Japanese yen has done. And it, to me, it's just following the trends. It's probably a matter of time.
Yeah, because on the day you and I are speaking, the yield is roughly about 1 3/8 on a 30-year bond. I mean, it got very low during the financial crisis of 2008 and 2009. Mike, did you ever think in your trading career you would see rates below 1% on a 10-year?
I didn't, but I'll let you know a little fact. I'm in New York, and I started in the business in Chicago, from Chicago, but how I got promoted from Chicago in the early 90s was by properly calling the bull market in bonds. I just kept saying prices are going up, yields are going down, and here's why. And so I impressed my bosses in New York. They promoted me here. I've been here since. And so I just never thought we'd get this low. But that's the key thing that kicked in about a month ago when Treasury bond yields in the U.S. reached the lowest levels in the history of mankind, in the history of the United States. That meant something to me. And now we're just seeing that lower tide kick in with the stock market. And I think part of it is typically when interest rates decline in the past, that would have been good for stocks. But it looks like we've reached that inflection point where there's only so much Fed easing and lower rates can do for stocks.
I want to move on to crude oil because it seems like it's in the midst of a perfect storm. You've got falling demand as a result of the coronavirus. As we look across the globe, economies are contracting. So you have that. Now you have supply being increased as a result of American shale. And now we have a price war between the Saudis and the Russians. Let's move on to oil and where you think this stabilizes or does this head lower?
I've been bearish oil for about 2 years and got a little bit hurt last year. The key issue was when it popped up on the attack on Saudi oil assets in September. But I am really no longer bearish from the level of 20 in WTI crude oil. 20 is very low, and there's virtually no producers that are making money at this level. So now we should see a major contraction in supply. You mentioned the key problem before. There was just too much supply. And the number one reason to always remember, people need to remember, there is too much supply is because of advancing U.S. technology. And that's where I think it was a wonderful thing that this year U.S. became an independent energy producer and an excess surplus producer of energy, partly because of just good old U.S. technology, fracking, shale, biofuels, you name it. But now prices are so low, there's just little incentive. So at least I see crude oil stabilizing in the 20 to 30 price for quite a while. There's really no demand. So the demand has to come back. The demand is just gone right now as we're in this global recession. It might print around 17. It might trade up in near 30. But to me, I'm stuck in its low range for quite a while. We should expect prices at the pump to just continue to decline to kind of catch up with this rapid decline in crude oil. I don't see the demand coming on, but I do see supply contraction. And we know, like I said, it's been going down since 2008.
Mike, let's talk about shale, because when oil came down from 2014 to 2016, shale producers were still able to tap the financial markets, get loans, have their existing debt roll over. That's not the case today. And what does this do for a vast majority of those small shale producers that can't roll over their debt and can't get money for financing?
Yeah, I hate to use the word, but bankruptcy. And that's unfortunate part about capitalism, but it's a good thing in terms of companies that were on the fringe and cannot sustain business in this environment will go under or have to restructure. And if it's done properly, we'll come through it fine. If you try to keep these zombie companies alive, that's not a good idea. And that's just typically, you know, we need to have some capitalism. This is just capitalism. The price is too low. I really feel bad, but I'm just pointing out facts. And that is prices are too low to sustain supply, which means you have to reduce supply. Now, I come from a farming background. I used to own a farm. And there has not, on average, the average farmer in the Midwest has not profited since maybe 2014. So farmers are used to this. And they're probably, and so this is just what's happening in the space. This is called deflation. It's a pretty strong trend. And a lot of it's on the back of rapidly advancing technology. And by the way, the global population on a 10-year basis is increasing as one of the slowest paces in history. So that's where demand is not picking up as much. And one thing that humans have always gotten wrong in history is is underestimating how much advancing technology can increase supply.
Let's talk about what's going on in the geopolitical fight between the Saudis and the Russians. I think economics will take care of shale supply, as you mentioned. If you can't make money at this price and you can't get financing, the result is bankruptcy, which cuts supply. And now let's move over to the Middle East. In this conflict between the Russians and the Saudis, rumors are that President Trump may get involved between that conflict. Do you think this gets resolved and the Saudis and maybe even the Russians, looking at what's happening to global demand, may think twice about flooding the markets with excess supply?
I hope that the U.S. does not get involved. This is a cartel that has been the bane of U.S. existence since the 70s. I was pumping gas in 1979 when we had the Iran Revolution and the OPEC cut off supplies, and I had to sell gas in half gallons because it went above a dollar and there was no pumps that could do that. So I hope we let free markets prevail. I know it's going to hurt U.S. shale. Right now we have the two dictators in the middle, two dictators of the biggest oil producers fighting it out in the sand box. And I don't know how it's going to get resolved, but it's a trickle down effect. This is happening because prices were going down in the first place, and prices were going down because demand was less than supply. It's just a classic case, and this is a result of it. And just like the Beers cartel, I have little sympathy for cartels that eventually destroy their own business with excessively high prices. That's exactly what happened. When crude oil was around $100 a barrel in 2013-14, that's when shale kicked in. It was artificial. And it's been artificial for too long. And now I'm living in my house right now. I have solar panels and I have an electric car. Where's that going to be 10, 20 years from now? Technology is crude oil is very important, but less so. And it's going the way of whale oil in the short term. So you have to advance with the technology. And this is just part of the battle to the new future, which I view as much more advanced. As long as we harness our technology and use it properly, again, I don't have a lot of sympathy for cartels that artificially boost prices and put people like us, our country, into recessions. And that's what they've done in the past.
So given this point from where your perch as you view commodities, you expect higher gold prices, oil to stabilize, but a deflationary trend overall for most commodities.
Yeah. Part of that's the dollar. All commodities are priced in the dollar. And we at the onset, we spoke about the strong dollar. So commodities as a broad base, the commodity index will virtually never go up unless the dollar is going down. And there, because the dollar is the denominator. So that's, except for gold. And that's what's happening. But virtually all the commodities on the planet, copper, the main ones, crude oil, corn, grains, all the ones that really matter are oversupplied. And a lot of that's because of technology, and there's just not a lot of demand. So that's been a pre-existing trend well before the COVID-19 hit and well before the trade disputes last couple of years. So to me, those pre-existing trends are just accelerating, just a question of how much lower they go. And that's part of the deflationary trends, and that's the micro, the actual market. But you plug in the macro, bond yields have been declining and just reached all-time new lows. They're all linked up. And to me, the first place you should see potential inflation typically is in bond yield. And as we know, inflation almost always is a currency issue. And until which we're potentially going to have, until the U.S. dollar gets somewhat debased, which it might, there's just no problems of inflation in this country and any world with any part of the world with a stable currency.
You would be looking at bond yields and probably the currency. Is it possible, Michael, at some point that you have the U.S. government devalue the dollar?
Well, we did it with the Plaza Accord. I remember I was in France when the French franc got hammered, and that was the 80s. You can argue it's doing it now. The problem is we're just catching up barely catching up with the rest of the world. We're just printing money in Europe. We've been printing money in Japan for, almost 3 decades now. And the U.S. is just catching up. And, we've had this flight to the dollar quality, but one can argue this massive amount of debt is the process of doing it now, which is in terms of other currencies. Most other currencies are doing it more. And that's where gold gets stuck in the middle. And gold is a great equalizer, gold price, because it's a solid physical currency without no one else's liability. Gold and Bitcoin, I should say.
Well, Mike, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow you, I know you write exclusively for Bloomberg Terminals. Is there any other way our listeners could follow the great work you do and write on commodities?
I'm LinkedIn. Happy to link in with anybody. Happy to, and all my information is there. And a lot of my stuff will show up in the public press and media. And like with you, thank you very much for speaking to me. And I really appreciate the conversation. But that's the main place. LinkedIn, just Mike McGlone, M, and only Mike McGlone at Bloomberg.
Okay, and the spelling of that name is MC capital GLONE.
Correct.
Mike, thanks so much. Stay safe and come back and talk to us again.
Thank you, Jim.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Are you getting closer to retirement? Do you worry about what retirement will look like? Financial Sense Wealth Management can help put your mind at ease. Our advisors can help customize an individual retirement plan that fits your needs and helps you get on the right track to achieving your retirement goals. We'll show you how to get the most out of your Social Security benefits, make the right decisions on Medicare, reduce taxes, and increase your return on investments so you can relax and enjoy your retirement years. Don't leave your retirement up to chance. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com.
Mother of all stimulus bombs dropped on the U.S. economy this week. We're going to discuss that, how this is going to impact the economy. And as many of you have probably heard, as of Thursday of this week, the U.S. now leads the world in the number of people infected by the coronavirus, overtaking Italy, China, with analysis predicting if this current rate persists, that we could be looking anywhere from 38,000 to as high as 162,000 people dying from the coronavirus in the U.S. this year. Jim, let's talk about this large stimulus bomb and the economic bomb that is also being dropped on the U.S. right now as we speak.
Well, Chris, why don't we start with the economic bomb? It's, once again, it's hard to believe. If you go back 4 to 6 weeks ago, we had the lowest unemployment rate in almost six decades. This week on Thursday, unemployment claims jumped fivefold times the previous high to 3 million, almost 3.3 million. And so they're estimating that by the time we get to the second quarter, we could be looking at, Chris, anywhere from 10% unemployment all the way up to 20%. You had one Fed governor coming out this week that said, hey, it could even get up to 30% unless the government acts, which is what we're going to be talking about, which is MOAB, the mother of all stimulus bombs. In military terms, you might be familiar with MOAB, is the mother of all bombs. It's probably the most powerful bomb the U.S. military has in its arsenal next to nuclear weapons. It's equivalent to almost a battlefield nuke. We used it in Syria to take out an airbase, but that's what this stimulus is being compared to, is the mother of all stimulus bombs. And if we take a look at what we're seeing now, we're seeing major corporations from General Electric. Boeing is laying off workers. We have GE Jet Engines just announced they're laying off 10% of its workforce. And we have anecdotal evidence of companies that were doing very well. There was a story in the Wall Street Journal this week about a print shop company in New Jersey that was seeing its revenues jump by 28% from the beginning of the year. Well, that was before all this hit. Now they're seeing a 70% decline. And we have a client who is supplementing their retirement income by renting out their house through Airbnb. And I was talking to this client this week, and they said all their bookings for March, April, and all the way into early summer have all been canceled. So definitely there has been quite a turnaround, and what we've seen in economic activity is more and more of the country is simply shut down at this time.
Well, as we discussed on Monday's show, Jim, this is a government-mandated recession, essentially, right? This is not a normal business cycle recession like we've seen. We have a massive exogenous shock facing the U.S. and around the world due to the exponential increase in infection rates of coronavirus, the strain that it's having on hospital systems. Of course, that's a clear bottleneck, right? That's how we have to think of it. There's a bottleneck in terms of the number of people that every hospital can service. We already have a large number of people that are being affected by the flu every season or every year as well. So this is just in addition to those high numbers that we see. And so, as you said, I mean, some people are now predicting that we could see unemployment rates move as high as 20, 30%. Just to put that into perspective, we saw 24.9% unemployment rates in 1933 at the depths of the Great Depression. So perhaps we could be looking at something like that. And that is why the U.S. government, the Fed, is responding the way they are by dropping this, again, mother of all stimulus bombs to try to prevent a large out-of-spiral depression or economic contraction.
Yeah, and that's what, as you pointed out, Chris, what makes this so unusual. In the past, when we went into a recession, it was usually 11 out of the last 12 recessions were preceded by two things. Either a spike in the Fed funds rate, the Fed was raising interest rates until they broke something, and a spike in oil prices. Well, we have just the opposite now. We have a spike down in oil prices, but once again, we had the Fed lowering interest rates. So the best guesses I've seen were probably in a recession right now. If you would have gone back maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago, they were saying, well, maybe the economy will slow down below 1% in the first quarter, 0 in the second quarter. Everybody is throwing out their estimates. They almost get revised weekly. Now we're talking about this quarter ending up being a recession, and the second quarter that we could see GDP contract anywhere from 12 to 24%. And Chris, you would have to go back to the Great Depression to see a contraction of that kind of magnitude. So let's talk about what the government is doing this. As we talked about, this is MOAB, the mother of all stimulus bombs. Let's begin with what the Fed is doing to give you an idea. Number one, they drop interest rates to zero. They cut the discount rate from 1.75% to 0.25%. Now, why that's important is when a bank runs out of money and they would like to make a lot of loans, they do so by going to the Fed and they pay what is the discount rate. So the Fed, when they cut interest rates to zero, they also cut the discount rate to 0.25% to make funds available so banks could loan. Third, QE infinity. Initially, the Fed said they were going to come out, they were going to buy $700 billion, $500 billion in treasuries, $200 billion in mortgages. Now, it's unlimited. So we are on QE infinity. Fourth, the Fed is now buying corporate bonds and corporate bond ETFs of investment grade. That was something they did not do in the great financial crisis because what was happening, and we'll get to this when we talk about investments, because we saw some opportunities in this area. But as people are liquidating their investment funds, whether it's stocks, whether it's bonds, and we'll talk about this later on, we saw massive, massive liquidations across all asset sectors last week. So the Fed is now going in to backstop corporate bonds. They're buying corporate bonds as well as treasuries. They are arranging dollar swap agreements with the largest central banks in the world because trade is conducted in dollars and there's a shortage of dollars. So in order to facilitate trade, the central bank is pumping out dollars with swaps with foreign central banks. They're backstopping money market funds, something they did in 2008. They're also backstopping commercial paper markets. Usually corporations, when they're short of cash, they will tap the commercial paper market for short-term funding. The Fed is now backstopping that. And also, Congress, in order to speed up the recovery and getting cash into individuals' bank accounts, they're thinking of granting and expanding the Fed powers to create what is essentially digital dollars where they can facilitate faster transmission of cash infusions into your bank account. In other words, instead of the Treasury sending you a check in the mail and then you deposit it in your bank, the Fed would just simply deposit that money directly into your bank account.
Yeah, that is a fascinating development, as we've been talking about for many years, of this idea of helicopter drops, right? I mean, now they're just injecting that money, if this is what we end up seeing, right into your bank account. We talked about for so long how this was something that could perhaps be implemented in the future through so-called helicopter drops, right? Direct injections of cash. It looks like coronavirus has moved us in a direction that was once thought nearly unthinkable.
In fact, I want to go through this $2 trillion stimulus bill, and I'm just going to cover some of the top line items, which are basically household and workers, business and banking, and personal finance. So this will give you an idea of what they're doing. $250 billion will be made available for unemployment insurance, and that's going to cover more categories of workers, including gig workers and also freelance workers. They're going to extend the duration of benefits to 39 weeks from 26 weeks. And on top of that, and we'll get to this in a moment, they are going to give an extra $600 a week for 4 months. So if you are filing for unemployment, you will get unemployment benefits every single week. On top of that, another check for $600. There's going to be $301 billion in direct payments to households, roughly about $350 billion in loans to small businesses. Now, here's the key. If you get this loan and it's used to maintain payroll, pay your rent, pay your utilities, those loans will be forgiven and converted to grants. There's $500 billion for loan guarantees to aid businesses, states, municipalities. $29 billion is going to be set up for cargo and passenger airlines. $17 billion will be for Boeing. $454 billion will go to backstop losses and lending facilities established by the Fed. So the Fed will be making direct loans. $32 billion to cover wages at passenger air carriers, $150 billion in direct aid to states, $221 billion of tax benefits for businesses, allowing businesses to defer payroll taxes. And by the way, tax deadline filing is no longer April 15th. That is being pushed out to July 15th, and $340 billion in supplemental spending. We're getting a little bit more details now that the House has passed the stimulus bill, sending it on to the president's desk. It has gone up by another $200 billion in the House version, which will be final. The stimulus bill will be $2.2 trillion. We'll be talking a little bit more about those details as they come out on Monday's show. One of the issues that some people are making on this is you've got three major companies. You've got Amazon, which wants to hire 100,000 workers. You've got Walmart that wants to hire 150,000 workers. You got, I think it's CVS, is they want to hire 50,000. The problem is Amazon increased its wage to $17. Walmart increased its minimum wage, I think somewhere around the ballpark. But if you were unemployed with the $600 per week, you're making $23 an hour. So some people are sort of critical of this. How does a business compete with the government, which is paying you $23 not to work? Why would you take a job at $17 an hour to work? So that's one of the big issues that is being raised with this stimulus package.
Right. And I think the goal, of course, is going to be to withdraw the stimulus. This is going to be in place for as long as we see the economic impacts coming about as we persist in a shutdown while the virus is going exponential and the strain is on hospitals, right? So all of this is going to be determined, again, by the virus and what we see in the number of infection rates. So a lot of these things are all really hinging on one very important thing, and that is the coronavirus. I think we have to keep that in mind, right? All of this is in response to and will be dependent. So we can't, it's hard to make forecasts, right? How long is this stimulus going to be? How long are we going to be sending checks? We don't know. No one knows at this point. The hope, again, as we said at the very beginning, is that we'll see a peak in the number of infections in the months ahead. Some analysis saying that we could see things subside or at least a peak by the second week of April. That's on the optimistic side, some pushing it out a little bit further into June. But again, I mean, these are all estimates right now at this point.
Yeah, and one of the issues that's also being raised by this, and it's even been raised by Governor Cuomo in New York, is that the cure, which is social distancing, could actually be worse than the virus itself. In other words, if you shut down the economy for so long, you may never recover. You know, think of a restaurant owner, think of hotels, you think of bar owners, people that are running businesses that they run out of cash. And the longer this goes on, Chris, you know, this is also, we get to the recovery. What will the recovery look like? Will it be V-shaped, like what happened to the stock market this week, which we'll get to here shortly? Or will it be U-shaped or L-shaped? In other words, once the all-ahead clear is given, will people immediately respond by going out to restaurants, to go shopping? In other words, will there be pent-up demand and money in the economy that people will just go bonkers and go on a spending spree, holding back money that could have been spent during this period of time? Nobody, and I mean nobody, knows exactly what this is going to look like when we come out of this at this point.
Extending this metaphor of the mother of all bombs, one thing I wanted to say, just to put this into context, is if you think about the USA, as we were talking about, we've now seen the total number of infections surpass all other countries around the world. Italy at 86,000, China at 81,000, USA now standing at 93,000, and the number of deaths at 1,384. The estimates, again, are saying that we could see total number of deaths, once this is all said and done, at least for this year, anywhere from 38,000 to as high as around 162,000. So to put that in the context of a bomb, imagine if you were to fill an entire stadium full. Most stadiums can run right in those ranges, tens of thousands up to 100,000 people. Fill an entire stadium full of people, most of them being old, vulnerable, sick. And then now you dropped a bomb on that stadium, wiping all of them out. That is what we're looking at, right? We're looking at the potential for that number of people dying swiftly from a coronavirus bomb, and we're responding in kind with a stimulus bomb to try to combat that.
In fact, breaking news as we're doing this podcast, the House just passed the $2 trillion stimulus package by a voice vote. It is now being sent to the President Trump to sign it. So the bill has been passed on the House side. It goes to the president. He will sign it today, and we will begin implementing the things that we've been talking about in the stimulus bill immediately.
Okay. So, Jim, let's talk about how, in some sense, you know, we were talking about unemployment rates could be as high as 20, 30%. You know, those are some of the estimates that we're looking at. A lot of it is going to depend on economic impacts, how many people get laid off. Of course, we saw, as you mentioned earlier, the unemployment claims number go as high as 3.28 million. That was five times the previous high that we've ever seen. So big jump there. It looks like we're facing a mini depression. And at this point, the hope is that it's concentrated in the second quarter with a little bit of a recovery in the third. And it's not something that's really long and drawn out.
Yeah. I mean, if we take a look at when we first started talking about this, Chris, about a month ago, the projections coming out by economists were GDP growth was slowed down to less than 1% for the first quarter, zero in the second quarter, and then start to rebuild third and fourth quarter. Now, these were estimates from companies like Goldman Sachs, from prominent economic forecasters. That's been thrown out the window. What they're looking at now, we are in a recession now, if you just look at some of the numbers. And just like we saw this week, the jump in unemployment claims, just as you have seen the exponential growth in infections and deaths, you are now going to see an exponential slowdown in the economy. This week's jump in unemployment claims is one of the first economic figures that we've actually got that is reflecting our current state. So now we're looking at a recession in the first quarter and a possible depression in the second quarter, where you could see GDP contract anywhere from 12 to 24%. Now, once again, these are just estimates. This is very fluid. We don't know how quickly the stimulus can go in there and maybe correct that. But let's put it this way. These numbers are getting worse, just like the number of people infected by the virus are getting worse. So do not be surprised every week when we do this podcast, the economic numbers we're going to be reporting to you are going to look as dismal as the coronavirus victims are right now, because this is going to go exponential here over the next month or so. In life, I think, Chris, is what we've got to be looking at now is when we come out of this, what is going to change? In other words, is social distancing may now become the norm. The impact that we're going to see on social events from sports, restaurants, bars, travel, concerts, conventions, casinos, movie theaters. It was just eerie to watch a broadcast on television showing the Las Vegas Strip shut down. I mean, that's a city that operates 24 hours a day. It never shuts down. Well, currently, it is shut down. And so that's going to be one thing. The other thing, and I think this is has a lot of positive attributes to it, is the supply chain, which currently exists in the world today, is going to be dramatically altered as a result of the coronavirus. In other words, China, in Peter Zion's book, Disunited Nations, you're going to see the possibility of the implosion and the decline of that country. Anybody that I know that is a large corporation is rethinking their supply chain on the positive side. A lot of that supply chain is going to be coming back here. If you have 50% of your market share is in the U.S., you better have 50% of your production chain located in the U.S. It's going to be very positive for Mexico. So just as these changes we're making to the economy right now, I would say, Chris, this is almost the death knell to globalization and locating your supply chain in one country, the risk and danger, because one of the problems that we're finding, whether it's masks, whether it's getting drugs, whether it's getting vaccines, 85% of those drugs come out of China, 90% of our vaccines. So, you know, it's not just the U.S. that is in short supply of these items. It's Italy, it's Europe, it's other countries around the globe, because they mainly come to us from one country.
Yeah, and if any of you haven't heard the interview that we did on FS Insider with Rosemary Gibson on her book China RX, again, she had predicted 2 years ago that if a global pandemic were to hit, or if we were to see a massive disruption to the global supply chain, that we would start to see a shortage in all of the important things that we need at our hospitals, our pharmacies, most importantly being life-saving drugs that are used. And that includes, like you said, Jim, vaccines, things that are used for treating respiratory illnesses, because not just China. China accounts for the largest producer. It used to not be that way in the 1990s. We slowly shifted from US, Japan, and Europe being the largest producer of a lot of these medicines that we use to China being the main producer over that 30-year period. But another part of that as well is that India is also a major producer of many pharmaceutical drugs, and they just took this week their entire 1.3 billion population offline for a mandatory lockdown. So the disruption to the supply chain here, the demand surge as companies stockpile medical equipment, protective equipment, drugs, this is something that is a huge, huge wake-up call for authorities, for politicians, for businesses on how secure are their products, knowing where they're sourcing their materials from. And like you said, we're going to see a decoupling on steroids, because the coronavirus has made it starkly clear that we can't be depending on one or just two countries for so many of our nationally strategic goods.
And it's not just things like pharmaceuticals, it's key raw materials like rare earth minerals. And Chris, it's also, when you're taking a look at this, it's companies, if they don't do this, you're going to see a backlash for that. These companies could find themselves in trouble. And so this is something that you're talking, just as we spent probably 30, 40 years heading towards globalization, now you're going to see reverse globalization over this next decade, because as you just mentioned, nobody wants to be dependent on one source, as we're seeing the risk to that today because there is a shortage. If most of the stuff is made in China, in every country, I don't care if it's mask or you're an automaker and you need parts, or you're Apple, you need supplies to make your iPhone. If factories are shut down in one country, it's going to affect your business. So all of this is going to change dramatically.
Jim, let's transition into some of the investment implications of this, and especially what we're doing at Financial Sense Wealth Management. Tell us, what are some of the things that you're telling our clients and other investors?
Well, Chris, we're not passive, set and forget investment advisors, so we're more on the active side, and we've gone from minimum exposure beginning towards the end of last week to neutral exposure. And one of the reasons we saw was last week was a record outflow. $109 billion came out of bonds, including one day alone was over $30 billion, $21 billion out in a single day out of equities last Friday. Let me just give you an example. $55 billion out of investment-grade bond funds, almost $19 billion out of emerging market debt, $5.2 billion out of mortgage-backed securities, over $11 billion out of muni bonds, a $3.6 billion out of TIPS, those are Treasury Inflation-Protected Securities, $8.6 billion out of the financial sector, $2.5 billion out of gold, and one of the fourth largest daily inflows into cash on Friday of $96 billion. So, you know, we went from minimum exposure to neutral exposure. So we were taking advantage of that. And there was a brief moment when all these liquidations were coming out of these investment grade bond funds. We deal in individual bonds and bond ETFs, but we were getting calls from all our bond dealers that were just scrambling, trying to dump bonds that were being liquidated. And Chris, we were getting some of the best bond deals that we've ever seen, but that came to a screeching halt when the Fed, for the first time, began to intervene into the bond market and buy investment-grade bonds and investment-grade ETFs. We were able to pick up some of these bond ETFs that normally sell for a premium above their net asset value. They were selling at steep discounts, and we were able to pick some of those up. But Chris, once the Fed started intervening into the corporate bond market, those discounts to net asset value disappeared, and we are now selling at 5, 6, in some cases 10% above net asset value as a result of Fed intervention.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. The Fed was looking at this wholesale liquidation of traditionally very safe investments, right? AAA or investment grade corporate bonds. And then all of a sudden you're seeing this massive liquidation. The Fed was looking at that and saying, this is a problem. So they, correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like they have now amended their mandate against doing what before they would not do, to the point now where they're buying corporate bonds and corporate bond ETFs, right? So this is a brand new thing that they've launched that we haven't seen before, if I understand it.
Oh, exactly. And in the financial crisis, their bond buying was limited to treasuries and mortgage backs. That has now been expanded to treasuries, mortgage-backed bonds, and corporate investment grade bonds, because that's where the problem is. And remember when we call them investment grade, 50% of all investment grade bonds are triple B rated. In other words, one notch above junk bond status. And that's the problem that they see, which is why they're intervening. And I would not be surprised, Chris, Congress is talking about basically expanding the Fed's mandate. We talked about helicopter drops. I mean, we may see something like this throughout this year. In other words, we have just extended unemployment benefits for up to 39 weeks. That could get expanded if we do not lift out of this going into the third quarter. An article I just wrote for clients that's published on the web is that this is stimulus one. We may see stimulus two and stimulus three before this is over. In other words, not just one MOAB, we may see several stimulus bombs dropped on, depending on how bad this gets, and especially as we head into the second quarter, when we're more likely to see the full impact of the coronavirus. So that is something, Chris, that is evolving, very fluid, which is why we've started a special show on Mondays, because once again, the Senate version was $2 trillion. The House version was $2.2 trillion. So the House just added $200 billion of goodies to the stimulus package, and we don't have the details yet as to what that incorporates.
So, Jim, as you're alluding to, I mean, we're basically in the early stages of the economic impacts from this. We saw jobless claims spike to over 3 million. That's the new record high. We've never seen anything like that. The hope is that this is a mini recession or a mini depression. Again, a government mandated one. It's not a normal business cycle, and that we will see some type of swift recovery. It's still open for argument as to how that recovery is going to take shape. A lot of it is going to depend, like you said, on the level of stimulus that we see, how quickly that stimulus can get to businesses, small businesses, households, to try to stave off a further selling, further panic, a further downside in the economy. That's where this mother of all stimulus bombs comes into place, of course. But that said, you know, we did see a pretty significant market reaction to the upside this week. Those that bought last week are probably feeling pretty good. But do you think we're out of the weeds yet? Do you think that we've seen a meaningful bottom in the markets?
I really don't. I think probably the worst side of it is, but there is a possibility we could go back and retest the lows or maybe drop by 10 to 15%. Where I think we see a bottom is going to depend on two things, Chris. Number one, there's two catalysts for a market bottom, in our opinion. The next, we've already got the stimulus. That was passed today. So that's behind us, which is what the market anticipated, which is why you saw the rally that we got in stocks this week. Two more things to look forward are the president says he wants to get to Easter and lift the quarantine. So the next catalyst for the market is when the quarantine is lifted. That's going to be a big one because you're no longer contracting the economy by government mandate. So that's number one. The second catalyst is going to be a flattening of the virus curve and its decline. That will be the final catalyst. And I could just see this, and this is one of the reasons why this is so hard to time, but the day the news comes out that the virus has flattened or the curve is now heading down, that is a day, Chris, you can see the market explode and surpass anything that we saw, for example, on Tuesday when the market was up 12%, which was the largest increase in the Dow that we've seen since 1933. So if you are an investor, look for the next two catalysts. One is the quarantine is lifted, because then the government mandate of contracting the economy will be lifted. And number two, a flattening of the virus curve and then its eventual decline.
Yeah, Jim, and I would add to that a well-articulated game plan for getting people back to work without the fear of a second wave coming back as people go back to work. So that has to be done in a very calculated manner as well to make sure that we don't see a second wave.
Yeah, Chris, and along those lines, one of the things that they're talking about, there's three major areas where the impact of the virus has been most severe: New York, Washington, and California. So they're talking about, if they do lift this, they may allow this to go back to the states and areas that are less affected, the middle of the country, less populated areas. I mean, New York City has 8 million people. I think Los Angeles is almost up there as well. So it may be that the quarantine is lifted for parts of the country, but not in those areas where it is having its greatest impact, like New York, Washington, and California. So that's something also we may see if this quarantine is lifted.
So, Jim, in summary, it looks like we're going to be seeing decoupling on steroids, skyrocketing debt levels, a new global order as supply chains shift around the globe, especially between US and China, but other nations as well. This could be leading to a decline in globalization, that is, the interdependencies that exist between different nations, switching from valuing economic comparative advantage by sourcing goods from places that can export those very cheaply to one of political advantage, making sure that we source our goods from nations that we know are politically secure and allies. That is going to lead to an ongoing shift, of course, and a new global order. And then any other items that you think that listeners and investors should be aware of that we will see from the impacts of the coronavirus on the global stage in the months and years ahead?
Yeah, I would say a complete reorder of the global political system, Chris. And there, you've done two interviews, two books I want to recommend to our listeners. One is Disunited Nations by geopolitical strategist Peter Zeihan. And the other one is The Storm Before the Calm by George Friedman. If you want to take a look what the next 10 years is going to look like, because it's going to be unlike anything you've experienced in your lifetime, just as what we are experiencing right now is unlike anything we've experienced, at least in my adult career, what you're going to see in the global order is going to be unlike anything you've seen before. And it's all being reoriented right now and going forward. In the meantime, on behalf of Chris Sheridan and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense NewsHour. And don't forget our special edition on Mondays, as we're going to have an expert this coming Monday and explains what makes coronavirus different from the flu, possible where it may go, and also possible solutions. And that's going to be on our show on Monday. So we are doing an extra show to get us through this. So be sure to tune in Monday. In the meantime, we hope you have a safe and pleasant weekend.
As always, don't forget to tell your friends and family about Financial Sense NewsHour and FS Insider, our premium weekday podcast. The range of guests that we speak to, including book authors, industry experts, and some of the top name investment strategists from around the world. If you have any questions, suggestions for guests, or feedback on what we discussed today or our program, feel free to visit us at financialsense.com and hit where it says contact us, or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.